This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio and online at kpfa.org. My name is C.S. Song. What is our longstanding fascination with zombies in fiction and film and other forms of popular culture say about who we are and about the political economic system we navigate every day? Mary Shelley's Frankenstein, George Romero's Night of the Living Dead, examples abound of our preoccupation with the living dead. In 2009, Time magazine declared zombies the official monster of the recession. In a new book entitled Catastrophism, David McNally connects the cultural omnipresence of zombies and other monsters to everyday indignities encountered in capitalist society. The book also examines the contours and perils of catastrophism on the left, on the right, and within the environmental movement. Its authors include Against the Grain's own Sasha Lilly, Eddie Ewan, and James Davis. Catastrophism, according to the book's authors, involves the presumption that society is headed towards some kind of collapse, out of which something positive may or will emerge, a new, better society, or at least the stirring of the masses from a protracted slumber. Later this hour, I'll talk with Sasha about the volume, Catastrophism, and her chapter in it, which describes and evaluates left-wing catastrophism and its consequences. We begin with a talk given by David McNally on the subject of his contribution to the new volume, which is also the subject of his new book, Monsters of the Market: Zombies, Vampires, and Global Capitalism. I want to thank WeAreMany.org for providing the audio. David McNally is a professor of political science at York University in Toronto. He delivered the following remarks at the Socialism 2012 conference, sponsored by the Center for Economic Research and Social Change. Here's David McNally speaking in Chicago on June 28th.
What's interesting is that two monsters made their appearance more or less on the same evening in 1816. Two English authors undertook a horror story competition at a Swiss villa, and one of them was named Mary Shelley. And she went on, as a result of this challenge, to write one of our most famous horror stories of all time, Frankenstein. I'm going to talk a fair bit about Frankenstein in a few minutes. And another person there, John Polidori, wrote the first English language story on the vampire, called The Vampire. So Frankenstein and the vampire are born in the early 19th century. In this 1816 contest, the book Frankenstein appears 2 years later. And while Frankenstein's creature, as I will suggest, morphs later into the zombie, we get here the beginnings of two monster tropes which have stayed with us for nearly 200 years. And when that's the case, I think we need to probe deeply and to ask ourselves what's going on. Why is it that these idioms of horror so dominate within the cultural landscape of capitalism? Because for nearly 200 years, dissection, body snatching, blood sucking, dismemberment have all been cultural themes or cultural tropes around which horror is organized via the popular imaginary. And it all speaks, I'm going to suggest, in part to this profound sense of corporeal or bodily vulnerability that everybody who gets subjected in some way or another to the labor market experiences in capitalist society. Or to put this part of the argument as succinctly as I can, capitalist society produces cultural fears or anxieties about being dissected and about being the living dead. And I think it does so because of profound experiences associated with wage labor. Let me start to unfold that argument by taking a closer look at Mary Shelley's Frankenstein. Several things are really interesting about the way Shelley sets out this book that tend not to get very much attention from most commentators. Victor Frankenstein, Shelley tells us early on, engaged in dissection and grave robbing. Now note those two themes, because they become incredibly important. How does he assemble his monster? He dissects animals and he robs human graves. And he assembles this monster by putting together cut up bits of bodies to create this gigantic monstrosity, which then gets jolts of electricity to be brought to life. Shelley has him tell us this. "I became acquainted with the science of anatomy," he explains, "and spent days and nights in vaults and charnel houses." Now, Shelley's readers immediately knew the significance of this. And they knew the significance of it because in one of the houses in which she had grown up, she was around the corner from the most famous prison in London where public hangings took place. And at most public hangings in 18th century London, this, by the way, was utterly unique in terms of European cities, very frequently, after the body of the condemned had been hanged, a pitched battle took place, sometimes lasting for hours, over the body of the victim, over the body of the condemned. Who was it between? It was between the so-called anatomists, the doctors or those who engaged in dissection and anatomy, who wanted more bodies to chop up, and the crowd that gathered there, often unrelated, but sometimes there were relatives of the condemned, who fought them off for hours. Money would change hands as they tried to buy the body, to bribe the crowd into giving it up. This didn't happen in any other European city, these battles. I think it's not an accident that London was at the economic and commercial heart of that country going through the most rapid proletarianization in the world at the time, that is to say, more and more poor people being turned into wage laborers, and in the early stages of industrial capitalism. The riot at the gallows, the riot over the body of the hanged, became a key contestation over the bodies of the poor in London. But note also that Victor Frankenstein engages in grave robbing, not just in dissection. This too was a class marker in 18th century London, because given that there was what has been described as a corpse economy throughout London, other British cities, but particularly London, a corpse economy meaning that corpses were getting more and more expensive, and indeed there were price lists for different sizes and sexes of corpses, and indeed price lists for each part of the body that could be bought. So there was a literal corpse economy happening. And as a result, the rich began to have themselves buried in things like iron coffins, padlocked, and so on. The poor were often thrown into paupers' graves. Very easy to dig them up at night. And so-called resurrectionists, or grave robbers, there were crews of them throughout London that would raid the graves of the poor and dig them up and have them sell off the corpses as part of this corpse economy to be cut up. And so we get in this period in London, the period where Mary Shelley starts to compose Frankenstein in the early 19th century, a culture of resistance against the corpse economy, against dissecting the bodies of the poor. Now let's step back and ask ourselves why this is so important, and why Mary Shelley knew this was going to resonate. To set up Victor Frankenstein in this way, she knew, was to set him up as a monstrous character before he constructs his creature. And think for a moment about what it means to sell your labor power in societies where there is no tradition of doing this. And think as well about the fact that we can make almost a trans-historical, trans-cultural generalization, that in one society after another, people resist being subjected to wage labor. They will do almost anything they can to cling to a small plot of land and try to reproduce themselves outside the market. Because once you enter the market, several things happen. One, loss of autonomy. You surrender freedom, you surrender autonomy. Secondly, you enter the economy of dead time. You enter the economy where for 8, or in those days, 10 and 12 hours a day, your life energies, your time does not belong to you. It belongs to somebody else. And if you think of all the expressions that workers use to describe time on the job, and I've used dead time as the most resonant of those, you can see what's going on. Marx puts it this way. The exercise of labor power, labor, is the worker's own life activity. Under capitalism, his life activity is for him only a means to enable him to exist. It is a commodity which he has made over to another. Now, to make over your life activity to someone else as a commodity means to treat it as a thing, to treat it as inanimate, to treat it as dead. This is to part with some of your fundamental humanity, yourself, as a human. As a result, life at work is a form of living death. It is experiencing death, lack of animation, lack of autonomy, lack of control, lack of creativity, lack of human self-expression, and so on, day in and day out, over and over again for a lifetime. And of course, central to it is the idea that your body is seized. And in one way or another, that body is disciplined, regulated, punished, and so on, by the forces of capital, supervisors, foremen, and so on, within the capitalist economy. And so anatomists didn't only symbolize the physical cutting up of the human body, they also symbolized the cutting up of our lives into dead parts and living parts. That metaphor, I'm suggesting, is one of the things that accounts for the great endurance of Frankenstein as a story across now nearly 200 years. Moreover, in seizing a body from the anatomists, in preventing it from being cut up, the crowd was winning a symbolic victory against capital. They were basically saying, there are certain indignities we protest. And if they couldn't resist the labor market entirely, they could at least resist this ultimate indignity of the physical dismemberment. You may be dismembering our lives, you may be cutting up our life experience, but here is one moment where we can win a small victory back, reclaim bodies from the corpse economy. But Mary Shelley doesn't only do that. She also sets out another monstrous trope. And she sets up the rebel monster or the proletarian monster. And I'm going to suggest to you that this is the monster that many of us identify with in zombie films. The moment when the zombies turn the world upside down, trample polite society, scare white, rich, suburban people by marauding through the streets and wreaking havoc and creating a zombie carnival. And what Shelley does is to threaten the ruling class that this is what they're creating. Think, to begin with, even of the imagery of assembling the monster. What is the proletariat? It is people thrown together in the most random way as a result of the cutting up of human lives and throwing them together into these big collectivities in factories, mines, mills, on ships, and so on. Much the same way that Victor Frankenstein grabs body parts and animal parts and throws them all together to create this huge monstrosity. That's what the working class is, particularly from the standpoint of the ruling class. One thing we need to remind ourselves always is how utterly frightened the ruling class is by the specter of plebeian or proletarian insurgents. That is their cultural nightmare, and it's one of the things that gets enacted quite often in zombie films as well. So there is that, but more than that, Mary Shelley's creature has a series of features that the Frankenstein creature loses in Hollywood films. To begin with, he has language. The creature speaks. Boris Karloff, the most famous of the creature actors in Hollywood, insisted that the creature should be deprived of speech, i.e. turned into a zombie. Shelley gives him speech. Moreover, he learns to read. But the capacity for speech, of course, is part of the threat to the ruling class. The monster is not a completely inarticulate, non-rational, unthinking brute. It's capable of communication, it's capable of thought, it's capable of analysis. But as I say, Hollywood zombifies the creature by stripping him of speech and intelligence. As that happens, there becomes an interesting point of intersection with the historical development of the zombie image. The zombie image begins in West Africa, but it has its most profound formation in Haiti. Haiti, of course, was the largest slave colony that France had. It is also the site of the enormous slave revolution that defeats three colonial empires. And the zombie imagery in Haiti becomes particularly resonant during the period of U.S. military occupation after 1915, when U.S. Marines imposed forced labor on large parts of the population. And this idea of being turned into a mindless beast of burden, to be literally stripped of your humanity, of personality, memory, identity, language, and thought, to be turned into nothing but human flesh that labors for others, emerges in Haiti during this period of time. And there's an amazing book written by an American author which becomes hugely influential at the time. His name is William Seabrook, and it's called The Magic Island in 1929. It's full of all kinds of ethnocentric racial stereotypes and so on. But the depiction of zombie labor, particularly in a chapter called Dead Men Walking in the Cane Fields, it was hugely influential in Depression America. That's when the zombie image first starts to make an impact. The book comes out in 1929. What does the Depression bring home as other than we're being treated as nothing but mere anatomies capable or not of work? It's this view of the zombie as the mindless laborer which becomes the main cultural trope of the zombie, the main image of the zombie, during the period of the Depression. After that, after the 1940s, the zombie image starts to die out within popular culture, only to undergo a tremendous resonance and renaissance, particularly with the appearance in 1968 of George Romero's Night of the Living Dead. Undoubtedly one of the great classic zombie films, except, I want to spend a moment on this, Romero didn't think his creatures were zombies. He didn't call them zombies. His original name for the film was Night of the Flesh Eaters, and he described them as ghouls. Now, why is that important? Because remember, I'm saying that coming out of Haiti, the zombie is a laborer, stripped of identity, memory, consciousness, and so on. The zombie in the post-1968 period becomes a consumer, not a laborer. A manic, insane flesh eater. Okay? There are lots of critical possibilities with this shift, but something I'm going to argue gets lost with this shift. to depict, for example, a voracious U.S. imperialism at the time of the Vietnam War as a manic, flesh-eating machine does have a lot of critical charge. And there's, look, folks, it's really telling us something that this film is set not in Transylvania, but in Pennsylvania. Okay? You know, it's telling us that America is a scene of horror. Okay? That it is the site of these insane flesh-eating monsters. And interestingly, there is one heroic character in the film, the single black male in the film, and he is the one heroic character. Everybody else is susceptible to idiotic panic. He's the one person capable of actually rationally planning a defense. And, of course, he's ultimately murdered by a kind of posse run by a real kind of redneck white sheriff type. Thank you. So there are lots of critical possibilities with the idea of the zombie, even though, as I said, Romero didn't think of them as zombies, as manic consumers of human flesh. But the danger here is that one of the really critical insights of the original zombie formulation, the mindless laborer, simply being a laboring, working machine, gets lost. And I want to suggest to you that a lot of that happens after the New Left goes into decline, as the anti-war movement and black power movements recede. It becomes very easy for the zombie metaphor to become a kind of easy cliche in which we just depict our society as choking on its excess of consumption and so on. And I'm not denying that there's some critical possibilities there, but I think it does tend to lose some of the amazing critical charge that exists. You can still see, I think, some of what's possible with it, for example, with Romero's 1978 film Dawn of the Dead, where, I mean, the zombies are drawn manically to a shopping mall. Okay? I mean, that's where they want to be, and they want to get into that shopping mall at all costs. Okay? And so, you know, there is clearly a critique of manic hyper-consumerism as something that drives capitalism. But as I said, the danger of that metaphor is that it loses sight of human labor as what drives the machine, is that it starts to drift into those analyses of late capitalism in which everything revolves around consumption. The shopping mall is the center of capitalism as opposed to the place of work, the site of labor and production. Interestingly, at the same time as that was happening, sub-Saharan Africa became the site for the return of the zombie laborer. And I wanted to spend a minute or two talking about this. This happens beginning in the mid or late 1970s. And interestingly, sub-Saharan Africa becomes that region of the globe most ravaged by structural adjustment programs, neoliberalism, privatization, commodification of fuel, food, housing, water, and so on, electricity, the great subjection, the greater subjection than ever, of daily life to the market that happens in one urban center of sub-Saharan Africa after another throughout this period. And what we get is the emergence of what commentators have described as a, quote, new witchcraft. This new witchcraft essentially switches from older idioms in which witches devour people to new idioms in which, in fact, what sorcery does, what witchcraft does, is to seize you and turn you into a zombie laborer. But what you get again in sub-Saharan Africa is the relationship between zombie labor on the one hand and fantastic accumulation of wealth on the other. The mysteries of capitalist accumulation are being explained via the metaphor, the imagery of the zombie laborer. And I want to suggest to you that that always carries a powerful critical charge. That rather than being some weird superstition, This is incredibly insightful, that people are using this zombie labor image to explain how it is that some people in a city like Lagos, which has its walled sections, its gated communities, where the nouveau riche are getting fantastically wealthy, while the majority are living in essentially shanty towns and so on. So I'm not trying to say that that's the whole story, by the way, with any of these images. There are lots of other things that always run through these images. Issues around race, an AIDS pandemic, sexuality, and so on. But I want to emphasize what I think has gotten lost in so much of the discussion, which is these class resonances. Because what you're seeing in this shift from an older to a newer witchcraft in sub-Saharan Africa is from the idea that witches are interested in use value, in consuming you, to the idea that witches are interested in exchange value. Not consuming you, not eating you up, but turning you into a means of production, turning you into a force of labor. Now, what we get today, in other words, if you take both sides of this imagery, is essentially a return to the vampire and the zombie laborer. The vampire is, after all, a consumer of others. The vampire lives off your blood. The ghoul zombie, that is the manic consumer, lives off your flesh and blood. The zombie laborer produces this immense wealth. And so when I said earlier there's a dialectical doubling here, I'm trying to suggest that each of these images projects to us one side of capitalism. Immense accumulation of capital and wealth, the hidden, usually invisible labor that sustains it. The idea of going onto invisible plantations, for example, at night, speaks to something that Marx talks about all the time in Capital. The fact that the source of capitalist wealth is invisible. It's hidden. When we move through the shopping malls, the circuits of commodities, we do not see the labor that brought these commodities into being. And one of Marx's great tasks in Capital is to de-invisibilize or to re-visibilize what it is that drives the immense machinery of capitalism. He tells us that to do this, we need a journey to the hidden abode of production. What the zombie laborer does is to remind us of that hidden abode, that somewhere, however out of sight it might be, labor is happening, and labor is driving this machinery.
And that was David McNally, a political scientist at York University in Toronto, speaking at the Socialism 2012 conference in Chicago on June 28th. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. The socialism conferences are sponsored by the Center for Economic Research and Social Change, the publisher of Haymarket Books and of International Socialist Review. We thank the center and wearemany.org for the audio you just heard, which was edited by yours truly. Now, David McNally was speaking on a topic that is the focus of his contribution to his chapter in a new book entitled Catastrophism, The Apocalyptic Politics of Collapse and Rebirth. The volume's other authors are Against the Grain's own Sasha Lilly, Eddie Ewan, and James Davis, and the book includes a foreword by Doug Henwood. Sasha Lilly joins me now in studio. Hey there, Sasha.
It's good to be with you, C.S.
So, how does McNally's essay fit within the rest of this volume, Catastrophism?
Well, in essence, David McNally's piece is almost a coda to the book. The book looks at what we call catastrophism on the left, right, and in the environmental movement. And that is the notion that society is heading for some kind of collapse, whether economic, social, spiritual, ecological. And many catastrophists believe that out of that collapse, a new society will be born. Now, just to be very clear, we're not suggesting in any way that capitalism is not itself catastrophic and that there is not a catastrophic environmental crisis. That is very much the case. But what the book does is it tries to take apart the rhetorics and politics around catastrophe and to look at whether it is a useful way of understanding the world around us and if it leads to better politics, or as we argue, a kind of disabling politics, which tends towards pacifying people, immobilizing them. Because what we suggest that links all of these different kinds of politics of catastrophe is that they are bound together by fear, that fear is sort of the operating element in all of them, and a hope by people who deploy catastrophic rhetorics that people will be scared into action. And what we suggest is that while that actually does tend to work for the right, it does not work for the left, and it does not work for the environmental movement, and we should be very wary of it.
So in your chapter in this book, Catastrophism, you discuss two forms, two versions of catastrophism on the left. We will talk about each in some detail, but I'm wondering if you could first briefly lay out the essential thrust, the essential message of each version.
Sure. The left has a long history of catastrophic politics, and it tends to take two forms, but they're not absolute, and often people who veer towards one side find themselves veering towards the other as well. So on the one hand, there is a what I call kind of a determinist catastrophism, and that is based around the notion that capitalism will collapse under its own weight. The other, which I term voluntarist catastrophism, is based on the notion that the worse things get, the better they'll be for radical prospects. So one is more mechanical and one is based more on human activity, but in fact they have at their core something very similar. Although we saw the resurgence of that kind of determinist catastrophism in 2008 at the start of the global financial crisis, where people said, this is it. The system has hit a wall. It's coming down. Capitalism, which has been haunting us all this time and which we've been able to do very little about, is about to crash and burn, and this is our moment. But generally, I would say that that type of catastrophism is less common now. There's certainly a long history of it, and I should be very clear, too, that catastrophism permeates all tendencies within the left, the radical left, certainly the anarchist tradition, the Marxist tradition. If you look at basically any tendency, it's there. But that determinist catastrophism, that expectation that capitalism will collapse under its own weight, I think has receded in many ways because people just generally are less optimistic about capitalism ever coming to an end, which I should say as an aside, I think is unfortunate because capitalism is historically quite a new system and there's nothing eternal about it. But I do believe that it's misguided to think that capitalism itself will just come down under its own weight.
You write that Karl Marx is often remembered as a prophet of capitalism's demise, brought down by the iron laws of history. On what basis is Marx so remembered, and is it fair to attribute such a view to him?
Well, it's understandable to some degree in that in his early writings, especially around the 1848 crisis, which was essentially one of the first crises, global crises of capitalism, he and his collaborator Engels thought, this is the moment, here's a crisis, things are going to collapse. But they didn't collapse then, as we all know. And Marx came to terms with this and recognized that while crises are endemic to capitalism, crises are not the same thing as a collapse of the system. That in fact, and this is something that I think catastrophists tend to miss, that crises are actually essential for the renewal of the capitalist system, that rather than marking out a sort of endpoint beyond which the system can't progress any further, crises actually serve to help restructure, remake the system, and bring in new vital energy. We've certainly seen that during the 2008 crisis, that it has been actually a tremendous opportunity for the capitalist class, even though, of course, some capitalists have fallen by the wayside in the process. So I would say that it is unfortunate that Marx tends to be remembered this way, because really, I think what distinguishes the Marxist view of social change actually has to do with the centrality of human struggle. But that in some ways has carried over, more that there are these laws of history. They can't be messed with in some ways. They're going to just unfold and we can sit on the sidelines and watch that happen. That's not at all the essence of what Marxism in Marxist time was about.
Can you cite maybe one or two radical thinkers in or roughly in the Marxist tradition who pushed back against this notion that capitalism would collapse under the weight of its own contradictions?
Within the spectrum of Marxism, I would say that, to sort of situate it more historically, after the death of Marx and Engels in the teens, the German Social Democratic Party was, in a sense, the place where much of the theoretical and political work of Marxism was generated. This is in the Second International. And there was a whole big debate, which I won't go into, about whether there an evolutionary road to socialism was possible. And there were a number of people who then argued this collapse scenario which we're talking about, including people who actually have great admiration for, like Rosa Luxemburg. But I think there were some critics who were not arguing for that evolutionary road, who were very clearly located on the radical left, who saw the problems with seeing capitalism that way. And I guess the person I would most point to would be the council communist Anton Panikuk, who said that rather than expecting capitalism to hit these limits, essentially focusing on capitalism's weakness, it really behooved the radical left to actually focus on capitalism's strengths. Rather than imagining that the system was always frail, always tottering, we should realize the ways that the system, in its strength, has pulled people together, has in some ways allowed for that kind of mass class struggle, collective struggle, that in essence is necessary to bring the system down.
Sasha Lilly is author with David McNally, Eddie Ewan, and James Davis of a new book. It's called Catastrophism, The Apocalyptic Politics of Collapse and Rebirth. It's published by PM Press. We have a link to that book on our website, againstthegrain.org. So the assumption that lies beneath this, at least this version of left catastrophism, is that the masses, right, ordinary folks, won't oppose capitalism, won't resist capitalism, unless it is somehow convinced that the system is dying, or it's dead, or it's moribund, or it's stagnant. What do you think, first of all, is that assumption what's really kind of behind some of this? And secondly, what do you think of that, and whether it's historically justified?
Yes, I think that's a fair summary of it. I don't think any of these thinkers or leaders ever articulated it that way. I think they thought they had the force of history and the masses behind them in some sort of abstract sense. But I do think there is a real current of expecting that people will not act unless they think that the system is moribund. And I think that is really problematic, because what characterizes capitalism is its ability to renew itself over and over again. So if you're constantly betting that each crisis is going to lead to collapse, and of course it doesn't, it's obviously not a great track record, but also it really lends itself to the wrong kind of politics. I think what's really important for us to articulate, looking back through this whole history of catastrophism on the left, is the need to oppose capitalism when it's, quote, working, as well as when it seems to be in crisis, because also in crisis, it is actually working. If we don't take that into account, it's not going to resonate with people, because we're kind of waiting for something which will not take shape in the form that we're hoping.
And I do want to ask you at some point about historical tendencies and when, for example, working class upheavals have taken place in relation to capitalism either doing well or not doing so well. But let's move first to the second version of left-wing catastrophism, that the worse, the better, that as conditions worsen, that actually improves prospects for radicals and revolutionaries. How implicated is Marxism in this version of catastrophism?
Well, you can certainly find that sentiment in the Communist Manifesto, that the working class will be pushed to a point of immiseration and will snap and rebel. Although there's actually even in the manifesto more to it than that. There is a whole emphasis also on people being joined together, pulled together in workplaces where they have some collective power. But that isn't the only thread that one sees in the original writings of Marx and Engels about this question. In Wage, Labor, and Capital, Marx argued that rising expectations can lead to rebellion, that seeing yourself do better because you've struggled and won, but seeing others, like your boss, doing even better, can set off rebellion. So it's a complicated question. I don't think there's one simple answer. I would say, if it does matter, and one could argue maybe it doesn't even matter, that the thrust of Marx's writings was to the latter, to the degree to which it really emphasized collective strength, collective power.
So specifically, what does the historical record tell us about whether worsening conditions and worsening living standards actually spur workers and ordinary folks to rise up?
Well, of course, the referent that we all have is the Great Depression. And obviously in the 1930s, there was a crisis of huge proportions and there was all sorts of organization that happened. But if you look at the history of the United States, that actually tends to be an anomaly. The struggles that won the 8-hour day, a lot of the key labor struggles that took place in the United States in the late 19th and early 20th century actually took place during periods of economic expansion. And those strike waves came to an end in moments of contraction, which makes sense because people have social power. During those moments of expansion, they can go on strike and not be laid off so easily. So one sees that in the early part of the 20th century. You also see it in the struggles, the last kind of big wave of political struggles in this country before now, in the 1960s. That was a time, and of course we tend to remember the women's movement, the anti-war movement, the student movement, Black Power. But we should also remember that was a time of intense working class rank and file militancy and class struggle in the 60s and 70s. People had rising living standards, and that made them empowered to demand more. Kind of goes against a lot of the logic, I think, that people have on the left, that people, if they do too well, they're going to be made apolitical. But the opposite happened. I mean, it was during a time of all sorts of struggles. And what really happened was the recession of 1974, along with a lot of repression that came from the government and anti-labor actions. But the strike waves of that time actually fell off after the recession of 1974. It's interesting because left groups at the time, or quite a few of them, thought, aha, you know, now we're having this recession. This is our moment. There was one group that said the 1980s are going to make the 1930s look like a picnic. But of course, it didn't turn out that way.
This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song, and Sasha Lilly is actually my guest today. She is co-author of the new book, Catastrophism. It's published by PM Press. She is also editor of PM Press's political economy imprint, Spectre. And her previous book is Capital and Its Discontents, Conversations with Radical Thinkers in a Time of Tumult. Well, of course, the late 1960s saw the emergence as well of Weatherman. What did Weatherman say about the wisdom, the idea of, in this case, provoking police repression as a way to build a movement?
Right. So Weatherman, I guess we could say, one would put on the sort of outer edge of the worse the better spectrum, those people who believed that if worse is better, then maybe the left should make things worse, create the conditions for people to become radicalized. So in the late 60s, early 70s, Weatherman believed that they could escalate chaos, that their strategy was a strategy of armed chaos, and that would create the conditions for the type of destabilization of the U.S. government and the kinds of political actions which they hoped to see. I should say that they ended up backing off from that position. They had a number of things that happened that did not turn out particularly well for them. But there was that thread through the 1970s. One can also see it with the Red Army faction in Germany. And of course, in the case of Germany, Japan, and Italy, where a bunch of these armed groups were active, there was a fairly recent memory of fascism, of real fascism that had taken place. And so they tended to believe that the governments that they were under in the 1970s were actually thinly veiled fascist states. And if they could create chaos, it would destabilize those governments to the point that they would essentially drop their shroud and the fascist face of the state would be revealed. However, their strategy did not turn out the way that they had intended. And for a lot of people on the left, they actually, the kind of escalating chaos made people pull away from movements and retreat. And quite a few back to the landers in this country did so because they were concerned about that kind of chaos.
And in your chapter on catastrophism on the left, in this new book, Catastrophism, you also point to the fact that chaotic moments also offer opportunities to the right, to reactionary elements.
Indeed. I mean, I think that's a crucial thing to remember when even taking the Great Depression again, that reference point for so many people, lynchings were on the rise during the Great Depression, whereas in the previous decade of expansion in the 20s, they had fallen. It's very clear looking around us now during this crisis, looking at Europe, that the kind of chaos produced by an economic crisis often really gives a boost to the right, because it's very easy for the right to scapegoat other people. And during crises, people often don't do what we on the left would hope that they do. They don't necessarily turn to sort of mass solidarity and collective action. They often try and cope individually, sometimes try and exclude other people from the workforce based on their gender or their race, or migrate. And these are individual responses rather than collective responses, and the right tends to do very well from moments like that. It is, of course, possible for people to organize themselves during times of crisis or times of chaos, but there's nothing predetermined about how those will come out, and very, very often they come out well for the right.
Are you arguing that radicals should hope capitalist crises do not occur?
I think that's a pointless hope. Capitalism is about crisis. That is an essential part of it. During the 90s, there was that sort of brief moment of total delusion where people thought they had gotten away from crises, that, you know, the stock market could go up and up and up, and crises were a thing of the past. Clearly, crises are essential to the capitalist system. And as long as we have capitalism, we'll have crises. I think the lesson that we need to learn instead is whoever goes into the crisis with more strength, with more organization, with more groundwork laid, tends to do better during a crisis. So really, if there's any sort of practical implication for the left, it's that people should think about taking organization very seriously.
And you use the term in your chapter in this book, despondent politics. Can you explain that and tell us to what degree it might bind together some of the versions of catastrophism you've been talking about?
Catastrophism doesn't come out of a historical vacuum. I mean, as I mentioned, actually, it's been with the left for the past century at least. But I would argue that the last 40 years, there has been a particular despondency about the possibility to change society in any fundamental way, and hence people have tended to fall back into a kind of catastrophic view. If we don't have the collective action, the collective strength to change society, then let's just hope that something else will do it for us. Peak oil, a financial crisis. One could come up with a number of different scenarios, but these are essentially seen as external things that will create an opportunity that doesn't exist up into them. Now, there are many reasons why that kind of political despair has been operative, including, you know, the genuine failure of mass movements in the 70s. And one could spend a lot of time talking about those reasons. But just putting them to the side, I think that although the degree of despair that people have had about political change is understandable, we need to very strongly resist it because it lends itself to very problematic politics. On the one hand, when the left indulges in scaremongering or fear, it can be very paralyzing to most people. People don't want to touch it. On the other hand, it can also lend itself to adventuristic actions by a small vanguard group that if you really feel like the world can't change unless there is some kind of catastrophic rupture, if you feel like it, even in fact you need to bring it on, that's the kind of thing that lends itself to having a small cadre of people try and take action in isolation. And there are serious problems that always arise out of that kind of politics. So while on the one hand, I think it's commendable if people want to see the world changed, and I think there is something within catastrophism which is, you know, genuinely something we can identify with, which is, you know, people want to see some fundamental change to society, and I think that's absolutely legitimate and fair, and I think that's actually possible, but catastrophism as a shortcut is not the way to get there.
Sasha Lilly's new book is Catastrophism. She has co-authored it with David McNally, Eddie Ewan, and James Davis. We have a link to the book on againstthegrain.org. Sasha, thanks so much for joining me.
It's been my pleasure. Thank you, CS.
And this is CS suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said, and we will look for you next time. Against the Grain is co-produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can check us out on the web at againstthegrain.org, where you will find on-demand and downloadable audio, and you can sign up there for our podcast. You can also give us a call at 510-848-6767, extension 670, and check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio. Many thanks to Erica Bridgman, who's at the controls today.